Access number 30649, Mr. Ted Hill, Real 6. Now, what about the next thing, perhaps, is the ERAs, the engine room artificers, first, second and third class, I suppose, or vice versa, isn't it? It's moving up, it's third to first. What were they like, and what role did they play in your life? How did you get on with them?
Well, on the ship, they were the skilled men, the highly skilled men, because they served a full apprenticeship either inside the Navy or outside. They joined as boys, the same as I did, but they would be more academically qualified than I was at the time, and they went to trade school at, I think it was Fishguard in North Wales, they went to for training, and they'd be there 4 or 5 years before they went on to ships. And they wore, oh, I always get mixed up with the rigs, they wore jacket and trousers like petty officers did, but they would be, when they came out of training, they would be leading hands, ERA, fifth class, I think they were, and they were leading hands, but they wore a petty officer's uniform, but a red cap badge rather than the gold wire. And they worked their way up as they qualified in various things. They went up and up. When they got to third class, they moved into a chief petty officer's uniform, which was much the same as a petty officer's uniform, except they didn't have any badges on their arms. They just had three buttons round the bottom of the sleeve. But they were skilled men, and they were designated. There was boilermakers, coppersmiths, you know, all the electric engineering trades, fitters, turners. And they were designated for work, you know, relative to their qualification and their training. They lived completely separate from, they had their own mess, which was an enclosed mess. So they lived completely separate from everybody else. Enclosed messes are what it says, that it's an enclosed mess with a door on it, as opposed to our messes, which were open messes. You know, there was no privacy whatsoever from the mess next door, because that was just there.
And you couldn't transfer to being an ERA. It's not a joined career structure. You couldn't become an ERA.
No, unless... You
had to go through the course back in England.
Yeah, or you...
Did people do that? Would people go from being a stoker to an ERA?
No. There was another route. They could... Alongside the ERAs were mechanicians. Now, mechanicians went to school for 2 years... and they would be stoker petty officers. And they'd go to school for 2 years. And they didn't live with the ERAs. They lived in the stoker PO's mess or the chief stoker's mess. When they got the buttons and became chiefs, they moved into the chief stoker's mess. They were ex-stokers. Because when you're a leading stoker, at some point, if you want to, you can do the PO's course. That was in St Mary's Island in Chatham Barracks for Chatham ratings, as I was. And you go there, I think it was 3 or 4 months, exams all the time. And at the end, if you pass out over 70%, which very few did, you're a mechanician candidate. Well, mine was 74 point something, so I was a mechanician candidate.
We'll come
to that.
We'll pick that up then. But that's the other route. So.
That's the other route to, like, being a tradesman.
Now, what about your officers? Your engineer officers, I presume. They're above. They're the next one up, I presume.
Well, yeah, and they were mostly Dartford and HMS Thunder are trained.
Now, how did you get on with them? Did you see much of them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you had a divisional officer, and as juniors, we saw them.
Would he
very
be
regularly.
An engineer officer? Although he was a division. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, he would be an engineer officer for a stoker. See, each department was an entity on its own within the ship's structure. There was engineers, electrical, seamen, supply and secretariat. You know, there was all these different branches, but your divisional officer, if you was a stoker, your divisional officer would be an engineer officer.
And what did they do? What would your divisional officer do for you? Or what was his role?
Any problems, you could go to your divisional officer. You know, if you got into trouble and you thought it wasn't right, you could go to him and talk about it. In a lot of ways, he was a counsellor. All your promotions went through him. And he was your liaison with the hierarchy, and the senior engineer or the commanderee was the ultimate boss of the engineering department.
Now, was that theoretical? Was that real? I mean, because you can have these systems where you can make you can go to someone, but you know, but no one ever does because they know they'll be on a charge.
Were they
genuinely sympathetic?
Yes, they were. I found them very sympathetic. And you had a hierarchy within the officers, within the engineer officers. You would have what were called commissioned engineers, which were ex-ERAs or mechanicians who had got a commission. Then you'd have sub-lieutenants who had come through the Dartmouth route and naval training to be engineer officers, and then lieutenants. And the senior engineer was a lieutenant commander, and the commanderee was, you know, the supremo. But the engineers kept watches the same as we did. I mean, probably not as frequent as we did, because there was more of them. And they just, well, they were stationed in the foreign engine room, but once a watch, they used to tour the whole of the engineering department on the ship. That was from the refrigeration, what they called the CO2 room. There'd be a watchkeeper down there. The engine rooms, boiler rooms, the evaporator watchkeepers down there, the throttle watchkeepers, which were ERAs. Everybody, right down to the tiller flat where there'd be a stoker on watch there. They would visit the whole lot once a watch. And they were the ultimate authority. I mean, if anything happened, they could send up for the senior engineer or the commandery even. And any unusual happenings, the commandery would come down anyway and grab all the logbooks. Because I remember once in the forward engine room, one of the turbines disconnected. And it's a massive castellated clutch. And it came out and it was bouncing. Well, I mean, the turbines are doing about 6,000 RPM. And it shuddered through the whole ship. Now, I was up in the mess deck when this happened, and I felt it through the seat. And the whole ship felt it. And the commandery goes straight down the engine rooms and collects all the logs. Because if there's any trouble about it, he's got the record. No one can say, you know, you didn't do this or didn't do that. And that usually happens when they're manoeuvring, you know, if there's an accident when they're manoeuvring the ship in harbour. But he did it for this instance. You know, collected the logbooks, because every engine had a logbook, which everything was noted in every hour, all the temperatures, you know, what's going on, the revs and all that sort of thing. Everything goes in the logbook, and there was one for each of the four sets of engines. turbines.
So that's what they do. Anything else about that? I mean, did they find out whose fault was it, or was it?
Someone, yeah, it was one of the Tiffies, which was ERA's, hadn't put the split pin in that holds the main pin that holds the clutch in, or he'd put it in upside down or something. But anyway, it vibrated out, and we were going at speed when it came out. You know, the vibration shook it out, whatever it, but it hadn't been put in properly. We never heard about anybody being keel-hauled or anything for it, but possibly one of the Tiffies might have been disciplined, but they don't, you know, they keep it quiet.
Now, so you joined the ship, now you joined in Hong Kong, I think it was.
Yeah.
And where'd you go first?
From Hong Kong, we was in Hong Kong for about a week, and we went down to Singapore for a refit. Because every 2 years, which was each commission, the ship did an 8 to 10 week refit at Singapore, and the bottom was scraped and the propellers cleaned and all that. And any new things they used to fit on at that time.
So that would be, what, still in January?
Yeah. And we were there till about April, May time. And
now, what was life that? Were you aboard ship or did you go ashore?
No, we lived ashore. When we dry docked the ship, we moved into Terra Barracks.
Terra. HMS Terra.
Which is an old ship's name from the Navy. They all are. All the shore bases. And we lived in there for a couple of months.
And what was it like in there?
Well, it was great. I mean, we were in double bunks, you know, one at the top, one at the bottom, in long dormitories, but we just slept there. We went to a dining hall to be fed, and there was a canteen in the evenings, you know, there was a beer canteen in Terra. There was a swimming pool in Terra, which was great because we used to work what they call tropical routine.
Now, what's that?
We'd start work about 7 in the morning and finish at midday, or half past midday, something like that. That was the hottest part of the day. And there were showers on the dockside where the ship was dry docked. So working in the engineering department, especially in the boiler rooms, doing boiler cleaning, you was always black. So you'd have a shower, change. There was coaches back up to the Terra Barracks. And you'd finish for the day.
Now tell me about boiler cleaning, because that's a job people often talk about.
Well,
I mean, how exactly do you do it, and how bad was it? Had it got any better than the old days, or was it still a filthy job?
Well, the inside of the boiler had to be wire brushed for any scaling, which you didn't get much because it was pure water they were using. And all the tubes had to be wire brushed through. That wasn't so bad. Inside the boiler drum, you know, you might get a bit dusty scrubbing away with a wire brush. But outside, if you were doing the outside, now that was a dirty job because all the boiler casings came off, and where the boiler tubes went up, it used to get soot between. Because the flames in the actual furnace, the heat and smoke and everything went through the boiler tubes to heat the water. Now they had to be cleaned, and you had like big blunt saws, and you'd go through the banks of tubes at an angle, and you had to work your way along every bank of tubes, you know, from about 6 foot high downwards. soaring all the time. And when you got to the end, you had to come back and start again, going at the other diagonal and go right through it again. And then you, after you'd sawn it, you had to do it with a long metal brush, like a wire brush, but it was very thin and long. You know, they're about 3 or 4 foot long. And then you do it with a brush all the way, and that, I mean, it used to take weeks to do it all. And, God, you'd get black as the ace of spades, covered in soot. There'd be other people up in the funnel cleaning that, because you do, I mean, you only get soot and muck when you make smoke, and in the main, ships don't make smoke, but they do occasionally. I mean, when you change sprayers, there's always a little puff of smoke goes out up the funnel.
Did you ever have to clean the funnel?
Yeah.
What's it like then?
Well, it's enormous when you get in it. You think you're never going to finish it. But there'd be, I don't know, half a dozen of us in there. And there was ladders in there, and they'd rig staging so we could brush all the sides. But you had to brush it. You wasn't supposed to bang it because it's so thin. If you look at the funnel on the Belfast today, or both funnels, they're all, you know, it's not a nice smooth surface. It's all in and out, where people have banged it on the inside probably during the cleaning, or seamen with chipping hammers outside. But they're not a nice clean as they were when they were new. But it was all those sort of jobs. One of the worst jobs, which was outside, was doing the propellers, which were massive, great bronze things. I mean, you get a couple of blokes on each blade, because they had to turn the blades so that you could get on them, get on a blade. And you wasn't allowed to chip it, because you'd make a mark in the bronze. You had to polish it, and you had sand, emery paper, and you had to, I mean, they would have scale on, because they'd been in the water for 2 years, and you had to polish it, and it was, God, it was back-breaking. There was no mechanical devices like these days. You'd have an electric whatever just to polish it off. It was all done by hand, because there was plenty of labour. And when it was finished, and it was beautiful, shiny bronze, an engineer officer would come and inspect it. And if it was all right, you oiled it, that surface, and stuck paper on it. And they would go inside and turn the propeller round to the next blade that you could get on. You know, it was hard labour, although the days were relatively short, you know, 5 hours or so.
And what about life ashore? Were you allowed out? I mean, I know you were ashore, but were you...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we used to... There was buses ran from the camp, naval buses. Every hour I used to go to Singapore City, which was, I don't know, 7 or 8 miles away, might be 10 miles away. We used to go through a village called Nee Soon, which was an army base. And the Gurkhas were there. And there was a cinema there. I always remember the cinema, because it only had half a roof on. And it had half a roof on because in the summer, in the tropics, it was baking hot, so it was well ventilated. And in the monsoon, you could all crowd into the other half when it rained. But I always remember the cinema there. And there was army barracks that, if you knew any... I mean, you used to meet the army blokes ashore, and they used to say, oh, come up and have a drink and have a naffy, you know. We used to go up there occasionally. Or we'd go to Singapore City, which had... There was a Union Jack Club and the Shackles Club, it was called, the Forces Club. All very utility. If I remember the Shackles Club, built of corrugated iron. But they, you know, they had food and drink and entertainment there and dance floor, such like.
Was there much drinking?
Oh yeah, that was the main thing. They go ashore to have a drink.
And how much were you drinking?
Well, not a lot, because we didn't have the money. I mean, my pay as a junior was sixpence a day. Now, sixpence, what's that? 2.5p in modern currency. But you think, that's only 3 and 6 pence a week. And my dad made me a shilling a week home. So I only had 2 and 6 a week. So,
and even then, inflation or not, that wasn't very much.
No, it wasn't. Because, I mean, when I was made a stoker, when I was, I think, 17 and a half or something, you know, my pay went up about sixfold. Because I was on boys' pay. And I went up to man's pay, which was a big difference.
What do you think the Singaporeans, or the, well, Chinese, Malays, and the British?
Well, the place was run by the Chinese, really, under the British Raj. I mean, these people, the British people out there, I mean, they only had ordinary jobs at home, but when they went abroad, they got really plum jobs, and they, you know, they never got the hands dirty again. And they were sometimes, I mean, I met a bloke, he was a ticket bloke on British Rail, in the ticket office, giving out the tickets to the customers. He was in charge of an office with 100 people working, this was in East Africa, East African Railways. Living the life of Riley, you know, his own house, two servants, you know, the man and wife living in, all looked after him. His wife didn't have anything to do at all. They did it all.
And how did you get on with the Chinese? Or did you not see much of them?
Well, you didn't see much of them, although, I mean, in Hong Kong, all the people who worked in the Fleet Club were Chinese and that. But ashore, they were very wary of you, probably in case you were drunk or something. Because I remember once ashore, I asked there were some Chinese blokes coming along. And I said, have you got a light, please? And they cowered back out of the way, you know. Which was quite strange to me, thinking, you know, they're frightened of me. What's going on?
What about the British one, the ones you mentioned? Did you have much contact with the British expats?
Not a lot. They didn't want to have contact with us servicemen. Army, Navy, or whatever you were. They were, I suppose, on a different level to us. They considered themselves on a different level, and they probably were, actually.
What about Malaysians?
They did the lower work. Because in Singapore, the whole setup was run by Chinese, and it still is. I mean, was it Lee Chu, the Chinese Prime Minister, was there for donkey's years as Prime Minister running the show. And all the prime jobs were Chinese. The Malays did the lower grades of work, you know, the labouring types of work.
Now, so you were there for what, 4 months, January to May?
About that, yeah, 10, 12 weeks.
23rd of January you went there?
Yeah, and we left on the 14th of April.
And anything happened while you were there?
No.
So where next then?
Well, after Singapore, we went back to Hong Kong we did exercises and all that working up.
Now, what were the working up exercises?
Gunnery mainly. And for our part, you know, we had to practice damage control.
Now, let's talk about that then, because that's something we've not discussed much yet. Because that is the traditional role of stoker parties. What damage control training and exercise did you do?
God, blimey, we were doing it all the time, actually.
It's a big thing, isn't it?
Fire was one of them, where these so-called portable fire pumps that seemed to weigh about half a ton and took about 8 people to move. We had to take it to certain parts and drop a hose over the side, start it up and make sure you've got suction and run a few hoses and spray it back over the side somewhere else. You had to simulate holes in the side of the ship, and you would put covers on an area and wood planks and shore it up with other planks to simulate a hole in the side of the ship. I mean, small holes, we had what they called DB plugs. They were great wooden things of different sizes, tapered, that you could put in a hole and hammer it in. And if it would get wet on the other side, if it was in the sea, and swell and really... stuff like that, all the things that could happen, you know, loss of power in this section, and they'd switch all the lights out and pull the fuses, and then they'd give you a job to do in the dark.
Did you have any special uniform you'd wear on a damage control part, as opposed to what you wore in the,
we'd wear what they call action number 8s. Which was like a blue shirt like this, but with double flap pockets and like jeans. They were called number 8s, and you'd have 2 sets of those. And you'd wear those for action working dress.
No anti-fire hoods and things then?
No.
Like the gun crews wore.
They're anti-flash gear.
Anti-flash.
That's for explosions. We didn't have it for fire because the hoses, you could adjust the hoses to give a wall of water to protect you from flames and smoke and all that, and heat. But the anti-flash gear was action working, you know, if you were in action stations.
That's for a cordite flash or
yeah, explosion. An explosion of any sort. But they practiced everything that could happen. They practiced at damage control. And it would go on right through your training. You know, when I did the petty officers course, we were doing it there.